I am Merrill Ainsworth. I am of the fourth generation of the seven generations of my family noted here in this recording. I am speaking today in November of the year 2000. I was born June 28, 1919, in La Grande, Oregon. These compact discs are the result of a series of conversations with my father, Roy Vernon Ainsworth, over the period from 1972 to 1976, 1 year before his death. His recollections were recorded on tape. His memory was acute and accurate, except perhaps with slight exaggeration in some of his fish stories. The original tapes, prepared with technology current at the time of their recording, are showing signs of age. In November and December of the year 2000, I am transferring their information to compact discs with a few supplemental notes covering our family's history to this time. As previously noted, this record will less cover a period of seven generations, from my father's grandmother, Hansen, a little Danish lady with one arm, to my great-grandsons, Jacob, Alexander, Chase, and Nick, with my generation being the fourth and being in the center of the seven. It will thus cover a period of 170 years, a substantial part of the history of the United States. Of the original tapes, the first covers family immigration from England, the move west to Utah and Idaho, and a few fish stories. The second tape discusses the family move to Oregon from Idaho, the years of the Great Depression, and hunting and fishing episodes. The third tape relates interesting happenings during Dad's career with the Union Pacific Railroad, and, of course, more fishing stories. The fourth is a further summation of family history. An epilogue on the last CD concludes with a summary of events in my family's life up to the present time.
What is the date today, Dad?
16th.
October 16th, 1972, huh?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, tell me, Dad, about the story you were mentioning. You had it in mind.
The one about Uncle Jim and Dad homesteading.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Up in Idaho.
Right.
Well, my other granddad, he was born in England. A little town called Wood Green. He was born January the 22nd, 1848. And he came to Utah he was 14 and a half years old. And they came in the wagon train. And him and his younger brother, James, and his little sister, Jane. Your granddad, Joseph, was 14 and a half years old. Uncle Jim was 12, and Jane was 10. And during the trip from the East Coast to Salt Lake, their mother got sick and died, and she was buried on the trail, and a stone marker put up for her, and left these three little kids. So my dad, or your granddad, he took it on himself to be the provider and everything for the three of them. And when they got into Salt Lake, good people that I wanted them to pull them out, one here and one there and one at another place. But my dad wouldn't go for it. He said that they were a family and he wanted to stay with them.
Pretty good. Have they been coming out with a church group, Dad?
That's right. They were coming out with a Latter-day Saints group. They were converted to the Latter-day Saint faith in England. And so they got a little house, and Dad, he took upon himself to be the kingpin of the house.
Pretty good.
And later...
He would have been about 15 then, huh?
Well, he was 14 and a half. And going on 15. But anyway, he kept the family together, and they grew up and just done fine. And Dad got a job, and he worked till noon, and then he went to school in the afternoon. And then I think he went to school at night, a couple of nights a week. And later, as they grew up, Dad fell in love with my mother, who was Hannah Marie Hampson. She was of Danish extraction, and of course my dad being English. So, and Uncle Jimmy fell in love with another girl. Her name was Emma Fleer. And they were married within a couple of months of each other.
This was in both the marriages in Salt Lake City?
Yeah, no. They were married in Brigham City, Utah. That's up north of Salt Lake. And I might mention that your granddad built the first brick house in Brigham City, Utah.
Is that right?
Yeah, which is rather interesting. He was a very apt mechanic and a good carpenter. So the boys, after knocking around and doing some logging and one thing or another, and helping build the Union Pacific up to Promontory Port, decided the best thing they could do was to go out and homestead some of this good land the good Lord had put here in this earth. So they took a light spring wagon and one saddle horse in the spring, I wouldn't say that it was 77 or 78, because and they went to a little town which was later named Cary, Idaho. And there the...
This was just the two of them at this point.
This is just the two boys.
Uh-huh.
They went up there with the express purpose of looking the situation over. And when they got there, it looked so good to them that they both filed on 320 acres of raw land apiece. And this was close to the Marley Desert and next to a little place, lake there, that was called Duck Lake. So they filed on their land and explored around where they could get logs and material to build them a house. And that happened to be 29 miles from where their land is, where they had filed, or going to file for their homestead. And they put up the markers and necessary requirements and filed on the land. And then they explored this possibility of getting logs to build log houses. And it was 29 miles from there up what they call a little fish creek. You were on Little Fish Creek one time with us, Merrill, when we had lots of sage hens to eat and ice cream there.
This was when we were visiting over in Cary?
Yeah, that's right.
Oh.
And so the next spring then, the boys moved in. One girl, 19, and I think Emma, Uncle Jim's wife, was 20, and they each had a little baby feed.
The time they got there?
When they left. Brigham City.
When they left Utah.
And my brother, their firstborn, was named Joseph Leon, and they called him Pat. And he was red-haired and had a beautiful dimple in his chin. And was really an apt comedian. So they had rounded up a few head of cattle and a couple of sow pigs and had a few chickens with them and cattle and two or three milk cows, most of them red durham. Some of the red durham is a good beef cattle and a good milker. And so one of the girls drove and the other girl, she tended the babies in the wagon. And Dad drove one wagon with four horses. And Uncle Jim, he rounded up the cattle and the extra horses and kept them together, and they moved into where they built their first little log cabin. On arriving there, the first thing they done was they had nice tents and set up for a living, and they decided then the thing to do was to get some preparations made for winter, because she gets cold and the snow gets deep up there. That's just 40 miles from Sun Valley, Idaho.
Had they got there in the spring, Dad?
Yes, they had got there in the spring. So they did, however, get in a pretty good patch of potatoes. So they had lots of potatoes that next winter to eat. And of course, the Lord had just made that country especially for people who came in there. They had all the trout they could want for the taking, all the sage hens, all the prairie chickens, all the deer, and all the pronghorn antelope that they wanted to just shoot from their backyard.
Is that right?
And so meat was no object for them. No problem at all. And they could really enjoy life. But so they got organized and the potatoes in. And Uncle Jim then, he was the horse wrangler, the thing. And my dad, he was the carpenter and the builder. So they didn't want to, they wouldn't leave the girls alone for my dad to go with Uncle Jim. So I think the first trip up there, his wife went with him and kind of helped him get organized. And he'd bring back a load of logs. It would take him 3 days to go up to 29 miles for the four horse was on the wagon and get a load of these logs. And in later years, I got to see the little ramp he built where he'd put his wagon to roll these logs onto the wagon.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Wow.
And so as soon as Uncle Jim come in with the first load of logs, why, my dad with the other chores around, of course, milking, I think they had three or four cows that were milking. And of course they had all the butter and milk and cream they wanted. and all the meat they wanted. And they had to have potatoes. Of course, they took good care of that potato crop. Now, a little Red River run right through their property. And so they had nothing to worry about, fresh water. And it was full of trout. In fact, when I was a young fella, I used to go out, mother would send me out when we were irrigating alfalfa, and tell me to get her a nice mess of fish. And she wanted them all about 12 or 13 inches long, and instructed me not to get them unless they were wiggly. She wanted fresh fish. Then they taught me to bring them back, and I'd chop their heads off and clean them out good and wash them clean, and then they would have trout for dinner or maybe evening. I'd pick up all the trout that I could really drag in a big gunny sack. But getting back to the building now of their ranch houses, when I bought the first load of logs in, well, my father had his tools and everything there, and he started building a log house for himself first. And this was a pretty good-sized log house. It was about, I'd say about 20 by 40, with a partition in between, that allowed for one big bedroom in there. And the rest of it was a kitchen and a dining and living area, with a big fireplace in one end that my father built, with rock they'd hauled in. And they have, there's lots of clay around that country, which and my father knew quite a bit about clay. And they would take and use this clay for various things like walks. And so when they got the house gone and this one finished, now what the floor looked like, I might tell you. It was kind of a brownish red, and there was no carpets, no lumber on the flooring, but this flooring was about 2 or 3 inches of this clay mixed up and spread out and smoothed down. Now, I don't know whether they used anything on the clay in the rooms, in the homes they built, to make them slick and smooth. However, when the house was built, I know that they took and used tallow. Now, the roof was made of this clay.
The heck? The roof too, huh?
The roof was made of this clay, and it was about 4, 5, 6 inches thick.
Hmm.
And then this clay put over the over there was smoothed down fine and looked a little more like cement.
Oh, I'll be darned.
And then they took and put this tallow, hot tallow on it, and smeared it on there. And boy, they had a good warm house and a good roof on there.
Hmm.
All made out of logs, hewed down and laid close together, and then the stuff put in there. And the big fireplace, I know, was used practically to do all their cooking. I think finally the next year they got a little old kitchen range shipped in 40 miles. It came in to Shoshone. They had to go get it, of course. That's 40 miles away from Montgomery Ward. And it was very interesting to see how these two young fellows, well, my dad, he was 29, I think, and Uncle Jim was about 26 and a half. And the girl was about 18 and, or 19 and 20 when they moved in there. But when the old snow started to blow, why, they had a chicken coop up so they could have eggs and chickens, and they raised quite a few chickens. I think the girls took care of the chickens and set them the eggs and one thing or another. And in building the houses, why, I think one of the girls would help my dad occasionally, while the others tended the babies, two babies they'd look after. And Uncle Jim, of course, he would do the hauling of the and the wrangling of the horses. And it was very interesting, and I might tell you something about the land there. The only thing they had to burn that was anywhere near available was sagebrush. Now, most people think of sagebrush as little old brush that grows 3 or 4 feet high and has little stems about like your thumb. But I'm talking about sagebrush that grows 18, 20 feet high, and the butt of the sagebrush is big around as your leg at the thigh. And that is the finest wood and the hottest wood that I think that was ever created.
Is that right? They had a lot of that, huh?
Oh, they had a lot of that. And when they came there, they knew that where the sagebrush grew big, that was some of the finest land. So on this land, they took up enough thing there that there are enough land there with the big sagebrush on it. It lasted them for years and years and years.
For fuel.
For fuel. And it was put on there. Of course, the girls did a little exercise once in a while. The boys were busy and with a bucksaw. You know what a bucksaw is, don't you?
Yeah.
And in later years, I can remember when we burnt out the big sagebrush good, that we'd go down below there, below Uncle Jim's ranch and my dad's ranch, with four horses and about two or three of my older brothers, and I'd go along to just be there. And they would cut a whole load of this sagebrush, possibly 3 or 4 card, and pile it, the big butts in and the little ones out, and bring it back, and man, that was really some fuel. And it's really interesting to see how those people went into these places and actually got along and just lived off of the land. See?
Uh-huh.
I can remember in later years that my father went out there, and in wintertime, they would come in, the deer would come down to eat in the valley, and he shot a big, fat fawn. And do you think that mother deer would leave that fawn? No, sir. She'd make little trails in the snow and come back and bat for that little deer. And so my father then killed him. I was there. And we drug them in and butchered them out, had a lot of good venison to eat, and they never took any more than they could eat. The only wasteful thing that I could see to it was when in their irrigation. They had no screen for the ditches, and it was just tough to keep these trout from getting out onto the alfalfa and rain in the water and then dying there, and the crows and so forth eating.
Wow.
We would drag in lots of the big ones there and chop them up and throw them in the chicken yard for chicken feed.
Wow. trout that had got in the drainage ditches out into the fields. And,
right.
Wow.
And I have cut up many of them there, 18, 20 inches long, great big trout, and on a big old chopping block and throw them over into the chicken pen. I could go on and talking to you, I suppose, for a week about that situation up there. But it just amazes me to think about how they moved in there. Maybe it's no wonder I had a little of the old-time feeling in my blood, having been born and raised up in a country like that, where you had to be rugged up there. There's no question about that, because the winters were terrible.
Well, how did they happen to leave that part of the country then, Dad?
Well, my mother was having arthritis so bad, and Uncle Jim's wife had passed away, that my father decided the best thing for us to do, and the doctor recommended, that we move to a lower climate. You see, you're up there about 5,000-6,000 feet.
Uh-huh. Now, how, when would this have been?
That was in 1907 when they left there.
So they had been there like 20 years, eh?
Well, about 25, 30 years.
Uh-huh.
22 and 7, around 28, 29 years. They had been there developing this. And these ranches were bought by ex-Governor Gooding of Idaho, was a big stockman in that country.
Wow. They sold the ranches they had homesteaded to him.
That's right. And we moved then to La Grande, Oregon.
Well, how did they pick out that place to go in Oregon? And how did they happen to go to Oregon? And
well,
what transpired there?
There were old connections that Franklin S. Bramwell had been up in that country and became acquainted with Dad and Mother, and he recommended that they come there. He'd been up there two or three times hunting and fishing, following around, and became a very good friend of the family.
Wow.
And it was possibly some of the best fishing country in the world, and possibly is today. I can remember when, well, I guess it was around 1902 that my father got a franchise on Cherry Mamayo from Peekaboo. That was after the railroad went in. We were only 7 miles from the railroad then. And between putting up the first and second cutting of hay, my dad would always declare a holiday for us kids. And we would go fishing. And we would fish on Little Silver Creek that run down through a little valley close to Peekaboo, Idaho. And they'd be usually three or four of us kids over there fishing. And all we used was a plain old willow pole with a black hook on it and a grasshopper in it. And we'd just sneak around and drop that on the water, and those big trout there from a foot to 18 inches long and just grab it and start off, and boy, we'd heave them out. We didn't mess around with it because we took them, cleaned these fish knives, and we took them over to Peekaboo. Every day we would take them over to Peekaboo. We had a saddle horse there and a one-horse cart, and we would take these fish over to Peekaboo, and they would put them on ice and pay us 10 cents a pound. And most of that fish went to Salt Lake, and in that neighborhood down there.
Wow. Now, how old would you have been then, Dad?
I was about 7
uh-huh.
when I first made the first trip over there.
Uh-huh.
and 8 and 9. I know I have the privilege of doing it at 3 different years. I've taken this fishing jaunt over there. There was no game laws, or there was no limit on how many you could catch at that time. And it was just there for the taking. The youngsters that stayed home of our family, why, which there seemed to be plenty of them, there was 9 of us there at one time, why, they shared, and we all shared alike, in the money that we would get from selling this fish. And by golly, I'd be surprised. Some days we would get nearly $30 worth of fish over there, nearly 300 pounds. Can you beat that? That's a lot of fish. And I'll tell you that Montgomery Ward's catalog, after we had one of those fishing sprees, had sure get a working over by us kids. As you see, there was no stove there then, nothing but little grocery store. It didn't amount to very much, and it was really, really something.
Well, tell me about the move to La Grande then, Dad.
Well, my father went to La Grande and Frank S. Bramwell. He always kind of liked to raise fruit, and so he bought this fruit place right out in May Park, they call it. It was part of the old Bexted homestead. And they had 27 acres, I think, all together there. And part of it was in Young Orchard, and part of it was in Old Orchard.
These were what, apples, Dad?
Apples, mostly apples. We had some pears, some cherries, and some peaches, and just a general all-around fruit ranch.
Mm-hmm.
And people would come from far and near there in the summertime when the fruit was ripe to buy fruit. I might tell you a little interesting thing that happened. There was three girls and their mother lived up above us there, and they'd come down there to buy fruit. And when she got her fruit and she went to pay for it, she couldn't find her $10 gold piece. To show you how odd things get. So, in about a week, while I was gathering up some pears and stuff on a little slide with a horse to for pig feed, and lo and behold, I picked up a pair, and there that $10 gold piece had gone to that girl. A fruiter fell down and hit it and knocked it right into the dirt.
Oh, wow.
And she, her name was Ruby Brixey. And she got a $10 gold piece back, and was she a happy girl. But really a funny quite a coincidence that would happen, that you would ever find that. You see, we kept the orchard pretty well mulched and cultivated for apples, and the dirt soft, and when this big old pad hit the $10 gold piece, it just went right down. When I picked it up, I found that $10 gold piece. Of course, I knew it belonged to him.
Yeah, and there's been enough noise about it.
This is an overdub. The following material is out of order from the original tape. It is the end of a railroad and depression story, which begins on CD number 2, track 2, about 6.5 minutes from the beginning.
So, he and I generally put in a couple of $3 a week into the kitty myself, and I figured that the Lord was pretty good to me. He'd give me a good job doing the depression. And we didn't know what the depression was, really.
Yeah.
So we decided then, the weather was kind of breaking a little bit. And the next day being Sunday, So I went down and fixed them up with a lot of more nice things to eat that night and told them that tomorrow night I would buy two tickets for Portland, Oregon. And I would come and get them and would put them on the train and head them for Portland in a nice warm car, which we did. That kind of ends that story there on one of the worst nights I ever spent on this earth.
Golly, Dad, that's quite a story. Did you ever hear any more from them?
I never heard a word from those people. Not a word. It's amazing, too, because they were so nice, seemed to be such a nice people, but something may have happened. They lost my address or something.
Yeah.
And I gave them my name and address, but I never heard a write-up. But you talk about a depression. That was the depression of all depressions in the United States.
Yeah.
I might add that those poor farmers down around Ontario and Vale, Oregon, were in a terrible pinch. They brought in truckloads of turkeys there, Merrill, and you could buy dressed turkeys, 10 to 12 pounds a piece, for 50 cents.
Is that right?
And you could buy 15 to 20 pound turkeys for 75 cents. I know when the first guy come by with a load of turkeys, I bought three or four of them, big ones.
Uh-huh.
And my wife, your mother, liked to have a fit, wondering what I was going to do with all them turkeys. Well, I said, I'll give them away. And then another time I bought a dozen capons, great big red rooster capons, you know, but dressed about 7 or 8 pounds, and they had a little chicken coop there, and I put them in there. And then when we wanted one, I'd go butcher one. And they were the finest chickens that you ever ate in your life.
Oh, that's all.
And potatoes, you could get them for 2 bits a sack, but they would like to have the sack back. That cost them a nickel. Onions was the same price, great big onions, 25 cents a sack, but they would like the sack back. If I didn't have any sacks, I'd just give them a nickel to buy another sack. And that's really a depression, mister.
Well, those farmers were eating in a way, weren't they?
Well, they had plenty to eat, but they just couldn't get enough to buy gas to move the produce to market.
Uh-huh.
And people just didn't have the money to pay for it.
Right.
There just wasn't any money available. Every night coming through Huntington on those trains, they had a standing order that no bums was supposed to go in the sand house. The sand house has 2 or 3 big stoves in it, and it's a building maybe 20 or 30 foot wide, and has these 3 big coal-burning stoves in there, and this sand that is picked up down along the Columbia River by the carload is brought in there and goes up on a dike and is dumped into this bin out of these dump cars.
Mm-hmm.
But it's all got to be dried and then blowed up into the container, which is some 40 or 50 foot high, so as they can sand the locomotives. Because wet sand for the sanders on the locomotives is no good. It just don't work. You've got to have good dry sand.
Nice.
And all this sand had to be dried. And then it was shoved up into the container that stood about 40 foot high with air, blowed up. And every bum that come in wanted to know where the sand house was, nearly froze. And that night it was so bad, I had that sand house just about double decked with men, not only men, but men and women.
Just in there to keep warm, man.
That's right.
Okay, it's October 16th. Correction, October 18th, 1972. Okay, Dad, you know how to explore the looking glass, huh?
Yeah, I thought that would be a very good subject to explore. It's mostly fishing and having a good time.
Okay.
So, along in the 20s and 30s, when the UP ran the regular passenger train out of LeGrand at 7 o'clock in the morning and back home at LeGrand about 5 in the evening, why, that was a fisherman's paradise. There'd be 20 or 30 fishermen every Sunday morning mount that train, and the engineer would pick them up any place along the railroad, from Looking Glass to the mouth of the Willow Canyon. And it was quite a sight and quite a smell to see those fishermen in the car. And of course, I happened to be one of them, too.
I can't believe it.
And anyway, the Looking Glass runs into the Grand Round at the junction, what they call Looking Glass. It's a beautiful stream. How it comes to be called Looking Glass? Was the water is always just as clear as a crystal. You can look in those big pools up there and see the fish down in there, you know, it's really wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
So, I had fished it several times from the train and wanted to get up farther on that creek to find out just put the oil in the box. The oil was just green on the other side of the hill. So, Orrin Wagner had an old, that's Pauline's cousin, double cousin, in fact. An old stack of wheat out there, and it was just alive with mice. Previously to this trip, I had caught a frog or two and got a little piece of skin on his back and a hook and put him out on one of these big pools at the falls and let him swim across. He'd get about halfway across and one of them big old dollar barbon or bullfrog, or either one is a proper name for them. They're a beautiful fish. And they're the scavengers of the streams, especially up in that country.
Hmm.
They'll eat anything. I have caught them with a small duck in them, a muskrat, and big frogs, and various things that gets on the water, they'll take it.
Hmm.
But they're a little different fishing, they are, than some trout. When one takes this bait, and they prefer live bait if they can get it, why, he grabs that, and he goes down to the bottom with it. And I don't know why, unless he munches on it a little bit before he swallows it. And when he swallows it, so when one gets a hold of your bait, you just let him have it. And don't pull on him at all, because if you do, you're liable to pull the bait out of his mouth or tear the hook out of the bait. And when he swallows it and it gets down his stomach, and then you tighten up on him, boy, you have got a fight. So we had the old 1923 Chevrolet then. This was about 1924. Just Kerr and I decided to go in to the falls. That's about 5 or 6 miles up the river from Looking Glass. And I wanted to try some of these big holes with mice. So out there in Wagner's we went one night and dug around in that straw, and we caught 25 mice. And we put them in a 10-pound lard pail with a screen over the top and a little straw and wheat and stuff in there. So we had our bait for the next morning. So the next morning before daylight, well, we headed for the Looking Glass. You go out through Elgin and turn off to your left there at Elgin and kind of circle around. And you come over to where there's a little old schoolhouse been in there, oh, maybe 75 years ago, perhaps. The little white schoolhouse. Well, just beyond that is where you leave the car. And there's a little valley, or a little draw, runs east. And when you go up through there, it puts you right in at the falls.
Hmm.
So we headed in there with our 10-pound lard bucket full of mice, and 25 mice we had in there. We could have caught more, but we thought that was plenty. But anyway, we got in there, and there's three great big clear pools, and the water is maybe 10 or 12 foot deep where it's been coming over there for Lord knows how long, maybe hundreds and hundreds of years. And it's dug out big, deep holes, and the water just as clear as a crystal, and there's brush up close to the edge of it. So we gets in behind this brush, and I drops in one first, and boy, we hook these little mice just with a little skin on the back of their thing, and let them out gently onto the water. And he starts to swim across, and when he does, why, it looks like the whole bottom of the pool comes alive. Those big boys in there trying to take him for a ride. Of course, one gets it, and you just let him have it. And in a few minutes, when you're satisfied that he has swallowed, well, you tighten him up on it a little, and boy, you have really got a job then. And those trout in there, Merrill, this Dolly Varden or bull trout, some of them weigh, oh, 5 or 6, maybe 7 pounds. They're really big fish, you know. Well, we fished these three big pools, I'll say from just a little bit after daylight till about 11 o'clock. Then we made a pot of coffee and had our sandwiches and one thing another, and cleaned our fish, and back home in the Grand about 6 o'clock that evening. And we had 19 of those big boys that run all anywhere from 18 to 26 inches long. And they're a fine-eating fish, too.
What did you do with the other 6 mice is what I want to know.
Well, we lost them somewhere or another, I don't know. But it's, if a fellow had been real careful, but we may have pulled on them a little too quick, getting kind of nervous, you know.
Uh-huh.
And they would let go. And then that ended that little trip. So another little trip that we had was myself and Uncle Jim and both of our boys, his number two grandson and my number one son, his number two son and my number one son. My number one son was about 13 years old, and his number son, I imagine, is around 10. And we stopped up at the hill where the old log chute was. That's beyond where you go over to the falls. And we was there real early in the morning too, and we packed these little boys with pretty good packs, the same as us, and we wanted to go to the old mill. Sometimes the fishing around the old mill on the main Looking Glass would be just tremendous. But it wasn't too good. But what I really wanted to do was get way up on the north, way up on the main Looking Glass. I'll cover that little story after we complete this one. But anyway, we had a wonderful time, and we caught all the fish we could eat with fried onions and potatoes and coffee and whatnot. And during this time, we were going up and planning on going up the main Looking Glass. That's a funny thing. 3 or 4 miles from the old mill, it'll hardly be any water in that Looking Glass. And when you get up there, about 4 or 5 miles from there, you've got a big stream of water.
Is that right?
And the best fishing that I ever hit in my life.
What happens to the water? It goes underground?
Goes underground late in the fall.
Hmm.
And there isn't any water down there at all. But anyway, after breakfast the next morning, bright and early, we were going to head up the main Looking Glass to get this choice fishing place. I had been in there once before, but it's kind of hard on account of the brush and the contour of the land there to just determine exactly. And of course, it was all my fault that we got up Brushy Creek instead of the main Looking Glass, because I didn't keep to the right.
Mm-hmm.
But it started to rain on us, and it rained good. You know, evidently got a recollection of it, haven't you?
Can't say that I have, Dad, no.
And anyway,
I can remember a few fishing trips, but I can't identify or relate it to.
Anyway, we kept plowing up Brushy Creek, which is on the left, and I knew we were wrong, so I started fishing some of the big pools on Brushy Creek, maybe 10 feet wide, 20 feet long, and I caught a half a basket out of a couple of holes there, all native trout and a few rainbow. And the one thing that tickled me, it just kept raining and kept raining, and finally we got up way up driven to the head of Brushy Creek, and I told Jim that we were on the wrong track. I was sure of that. If we had went up the other side, we'd have been all right.
Mm-hmm.
But he kept asking his number two son, Don, if he was having a good time. And yes. And about the fourth time he asked Don if he was having a good time, and the rain was running down around his ears and his neck, "Don, you having a good time?" "Hell no, Dad."
Decided to be honest, huh?
But we had to pull out of there that night. If we'd have stayed another day, well, I'd have known where to go to get up on the main Looking Glass.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, we came back to camp and built a good fire at the old mill and had lots of feed, and the sun come out, and then we had a good time. But one thing I never will forget, we packed you boys in proportion just as heavy as we did. I was about 33, I imagine, at that time, and 32 or 3, and Uncle Jim was probably 40. And you kids would run along with your packs up the trail, going up to the old mill, ahead of us about 300 or 400 yards. Lay your packs down, and then you start rolling rocks and throwing rocks and climbing trees and just having a great time. Well, those little fellows would cut along there with their tongue hanging out and sweating like a trooper. So anyway, we had a wonderful time, and one that I will never forget. Now we'll get on to another little story about Jess Kerr came up from Huntington, and he wanted to hunt deer over on the main Looking Glass on the East Ridge. So he called me up at the Grand, and we made a date, and we went in there, and we went into the old mill, left our camping equipment there, and we hunted on the East Ridge from the main Looking Glass. And we hunted early in the morning. We saw several does and fawns, but we never did get a chance to shoot a buck. But we had our fishing tackle with us and some good cured angleworms. What I mean about cured angleworms, this might be good for Mike to know too. We would dig these angleworms, and we would put them in grass and grass roots for 4 or 5 days, and it would kind of fizzle all the dirt out of them, and they would be nice and pink and red and lively as a could be. And that was the way to use angleworm for fishing, because when you put them on there, he started to wiggle. Mr. Trout thought he was
pretty hot stuff, huh?
Pretty hot stuff is right. But anyway, we hunted till about 9 o'clock and went down where there was a great big old fir tree. I can see it yet. And there was a good stream of water there. And none coming in down there at the mill. In fact, a big stream. And we set up our fishing tackle and we went to fishing. We figured we only had 2 hours because the boys was going to have dinner about noon or 1 o'clock, and then we had about 4 or 5 miles to hike to where the car was. Well, we started fishing. And I'm telling you, Merrill, I never saw such beautiful fish, rainbow trout, in my life. And every one of them looked like they were hatched out at the same time. They were about from 12 and a half to 12 and three-quarter inches long, and every one of them. And I caught 53 in 2 hours. I had a nice big basket full of trout. And Jess Kerr, he had 37, but he had one bigger one than me. He cut one bull trout 17 inches long.
Wow.
And so then we headed back, and of course on those trips, we always put up 50 cents apiece for the guy that catches the big trout. And Jess, he was sure he had it. And finally, his brother-in-law, Leo, and his boy, Jess's oldest boy, were fishing. 4 of us went in on that trip. Well, pretty soon we come where Leo had cleaned his fish, and Jess says, "Oh my goodness," he says, "here's one with the guts as big as the fish I caught." That Leo Browns, why, Jess's brother-in-law, happened to catch one of the big bull trout. Anyway, we got back and boiled potatoes and had butter and on them and all the fried trout you could eat and coffee and bread and jelly, and we was ready to go home. And we stopped in Ellison, and I got 50 pounds ice because we really had a load of fish. So home in good time, and I put those fish down in the basement. I took part of that ice and then got some more ice. And I put those fish on ice in the basement on the dirt floor with a burlap sack under them. And I covered them with a big old quilt. And you know, we had them off the ice there for 2 weeks that were just perfect to eat.
Isn't it?
Yeah. Now another little trip that we had over there was during grouse season. Jim and I and Roy Cusick went over to hunt. And of course, as per usual, we wanted to make the old mill our headquarters, which we did. And we caught all the fish we could eat, and we got a few grouse, but it was not, you know, too good. So we decided to move down to the point where the north fork of the Looking Glass comes into the main Looking Glass. And we got down there all around 3 o'clock in the afternoon. We were not having too much, too heavily loaded.
Were you going to stay overnight then?
Yeah, we stayed overnight on the point. But anyway, we got down to the point and we wanted to cover as much of the ground as we could fishing. So Jim wanted to go up the north fork of the Looking Glass and Cusick wanted to go up the main Looking Glass. Well, I said, I'll go down the main Looking Glass. So